Okay, thanks. It's a pleasure to be giving this talk. This talk is largely going to be a review. Basically, I want to set the stage for the recent progress in N equals 4A Mills theory. And my two specific motivations are, first of all, many of the people in here are my friends and collaborators from the past many years, so I think we all deserve a collective pat on the back for all of the accomplishments we've made in the last several years, especially since the 2004 KITP program, where a lot of us really got started working on this subject. But also, I hope to provide a stirring motivational speech. There's still a lot of work to be done. We're here to get some of that work done, so let's get busy. But also, I'm sorry, I'm not connected.
Yes.
You gotta restart it.
Oh, I gotta restart. still got it. Thanks.
People around the world are waiting to listen.
That's right. But also for the newcomers in the audience, I think this field has achieved somewhat of a cult-like status. And a lot of the times when I'm talking to friends of mine at conferences,
Let me adjust the mic.
It's a little bit higher. Okay.
And last one, I promise.
All right, I think we're good to go. So one of the common things we discuss is, why aren't more people working in this field? So we think this is a really great field. We think it's one of the most amazing things in the universe, and I hope to convey some of that excitement to you. So I want to convey some of the philosophy of our cult, and also a gentle introduction to some of its jargon, because certainly there is a lot of jargon in our field, and there are going to be lots of talks over the next few weeks, so it would be good to get some of that out of the way, so you know what people are talking about. Now, one of the major appeals of this field is that it has achieved a long-lasting vitality, something that's not very common. A lot of high energy theory is driven by fads with time scales of a year or even less. But from 2004 through 2011, and hopefully well beyond, it's really fair to say that it's often been the case that the phase transition between impossible and trivial has frequently occurred on the time scale of months instead of years. And this is just really spectacular progress. Now, a corollary of that is that many people, myself included, if I have to be honest, have written papers that required a lot of hard work, and only a few months later they were completely trivial. And, you know, we shouldn't be ashamed of that. Rather, that's a testament to the growing and active field. So, in other words, I think that the communal pride we can take in the pushing the knowledge forward trumps the occasional individual shame. Many people have made significant contributions to this field. I think I've only named a few of them. I was editing this list up to 3 minutes ago, so I'm sure I some important people. In a nutshell, the goals of this research program are twofold. First of all, to explore the rich mathematical structure of scattering amplitudes, particularly in maximally supersymmetric theory. And second of all, to exploit that structure to make previously impossible calculations trivial. And this word trivial is really not an exaggeration. String theorists, the background they come from, often like to overhype their accomplishments. But it really is the case that the technology that's been developed over this last several years just really makes calculations that used to be impossible so trivial that you can just write down the answers. Now, why N equals 4 super Yang-Mills theory? Well, it's a beautiful quantum field theory. It'll be 35 years old this year. And it's apparently a non-trivial example of a solvable, or integrable in a certain sense, and in the planar limit at least, four-dimensional quantum field theory. But even more than that, it's not just some random quantum field theory. If someone came to you tomorrow and wrote down some bizarre Lagrangian and said, hey, I think this is a solvable quantum field theory in four dimensions, you might not really care so much. But N equals 4 super Yang-Mills, of course, is not a random QEFT, it's a gauge theory, and hence a close cousin of QCD. I put in the word close because I'm in a relatively friendly audience. When I talk in front of really hardcore QCD people, I say maybe it's a distant, estranged cousin of QCD. But amongst string theorists, you take N equals 4, you have Joe throw in a few of his brains, and okay, there's QCD. But and more importantly, of course, via the ADS-CFT correspondence, N equals Fourier-Yang-Mills theory is equal to quantum gravity in ADS space. But I think I can go ahead and be honest that for many of us, a sufficient motivation for being interested in this field is that it is there, and yes, we can. Zvi Byrne in his colloquium on Tuesday expressed confidence that, you know, we're going to solve this theory, and I think everyone believes that to be true, and so let's just do it.
All right.
Yeah, of course. Yes. Now, at the very least, absolutely. Now, I want to say just a word about the relation between the current ideas and the old S-matrix theory, because a lot of the spirit behind recent progress is very similar. That is that, you know, we should look for things that don't require you to have a local space-time description, because we're talking about scattering matrix elements that map minus infinity to infinity. So there should be some way of formulating that without requiring local space-time. But I want to emphasize some of the differences between the old approach. And the first is that if we have seen any further than the people of the past, it's because we're focused squarely on the well-manicured lawn beneath our feet, that is N equals Fourier-Yang-Mills theory, rather than the dark jungle looming ahead. But more importantly, there's a completely different philosophy. Back then, as far as I understand, the idea was to try to enumerate the principles you wanted an S-matrix to satisfy, and then solve those principles, solve those constraints to get the QCD S-matrix, as if that were possible. Well, now our aim is completely the reverse. I think it's fair to say that many people in our community think that the idea is let's get the answer. Let's just, you know, by any means necessary, write down the solution and then try to deduce the principles or the properties by staring at its structure. And the reason why this is important is often it's the case that the principles that are encoded in the structure of the solution are things that you might never have thought of. One example that comes to mind in N equals 4 Super-Yang-Mills theory is dual conformal invariance that I will talk about shortly. You never would have thought of, you probably never would have thought of enumerating dual conformal invariance as one of your principles until you had seen some data. Okay, so much for introduction. Now let's begin the laundry list of jargon. First of all, what are the amplitudes that we focus on? So for almost all of my talk, I'll be focusing on planar color-stripped partial amplitudes in N equals Super-Yang-Mills theory. Now, there is a lot of structure also beyond just this limit. Zvi Byrne mentioned some of the intriguing developments regarding duality between color and kinematics in his colloquium on Tuesday, and there's a lot of intriguing structure in that direction that's only beginning to be explored, but the vast majority of the work that I'll be reviewing today deals with color-stripped planar amplitudes. So planar means that your amplitude has only a single trace structure, where in N equals Fourier-Yang-Mills theory, where everything is in the adjoint, so there's a single trace factor involving the generators of the gauge group. We're talking about bosons, so of course the amplitude has to be fully permutation symmetric. So when we talk about a color-ordered partial amplitude, we mean the particular coefficient that sits in front of a particular color-ordered factor. Now let me talk a little bit about the word representation, because as you hear the talks over the next several weeks, you'll often hear people talking about the BCFW representation, or this representation, or that representation. So what is a representation of an amplitude? Well, we don't mean it strictly in the sense of group theory, although who knows, maybe there's some group underlying it. We just mean different formulas for the same thing. So let me dirty my hands a little bit by giving an example from massless phi cube theory. There's a formula for the tree-level four-point amplitude. There's another formula for the tree-level four-point amplitude. They're exactly the same. They don't look the same, but they're the same. Now, in this case, it's trivial to see that these are identical if you just remember the constraint on the three Mandelstam variables. Now, this is a linear constraint, which means you can trivially solve it in terms of two free variables. Pick whichever two you want, S and T, for example. You solve U in terms of S and T, plug it in here, and this thing will simplify to something equaling that. Now, in general, it's not so easy to determine if two representations of the same quantity are equal. When we talk about the scattering of particles with spin, it's convenient to use spinner helicity variables to trivialize the on-shell condition for each particle. So every particle in our scattering amplitude has to have k squared equals zero. We can solve that in the following way. By using the Pauli matrices, we can convert the four vector k mu into a 2x2 matrix. Then the fact that this is null means the 2x2 matrix should have rank 1, which means it should be a product of an outer product of two-component objects called the spinner helicity variables. So just by virtue of writing this parameterizing k mu in this way means you automatically solve k squared equals 0. So these lambdas and lambda bars, or lambda tildes, are sort of free variables in the sense that they trivialize that constraint. They don't yet trivialize the overall momentum conservation. I'll get to that later on in the talk. You still need to impose that the sum of all external momenta participating in a process is equal to zero. Then by way of notation, we use these angle brackets to denote the 2x2 anti-symmetric inner product of the lambdas, the square bracket to denote the 2x2 anti-symmetric inner product. Oh, those should be bars. I apologize for that. And there's some more complicated invariants you can form. They won't appear very much in my talk, but you'll see them occasionally. Next comes the concept of MHV. So a spin 1 particle, of course, has two physical states, helicity plus 1 or minus 1. The n particle MHV amplitude is the one that involves this is a definition. MHV means maximally helicity violating, and it refers to an amplitude with n minus 2 particles of one helicity, call it plus, and 2 particles of the opposite helicity. It turns out that this is the first case which is non-vanishing. Then the NMHV refers to next to MHV, or N minus 3 positive and 3 negative, and then you can go down the line, N squared, MHV, etc. Now, some time ago, a compact explicit formula was discovered for the general tree-level MHV scattering amplitude. And I should emphasize, the formula is equally good in QCD as it is in N equals 4 Yang-Mills theory, since it's a tree-level formula. It knows nothing about supersymmetry, doesn't care about supersymmetry at all. Proven by Behrens and Keeley in 88, and first written down by Park and Taylor in 86. Now, I really think it's completely fair to say that for our field, this is perhaps the most important formula in the entire field from a psychological standpoint. Because once you appreciate the fact, let's look at an eight gluon amplitude. Via traditional Feynman diagram techniques, in order to get that answer, you'd have to sum up around 34,000 Feynman diagrams, each one of which is a complete mess. And now if someone comes along and tells you that the answer is really just given by that formula, that sends a strong message. And the message that we in our community take is that simplifications of this nature, of this order of magnitude, do not happen by accident. There has to be a reason behind them. So if you're on board with this sentiment, then you're one-third of the way towards becoming an amplitudeologist. So it behooves us to try to figure out what is it that's causing that simplification. Okay, well, let me continue my little laundry list here. In N equals 4 Yang-Mills theory, we can use a convenient bookkeeping device, which is to work in superspace. And all that really means is that we, for a given n, for a given number of particles, you just add together the MHV amplitude, the NMHV amplitude, the N squared MHV amplitude. You add them all up, but you factor out an overall factor of the MHV amplitude. And this contains an overall delta function of supermomentum conservation. This is an eight-dimensional delta function because it has free indices, little a, which run over the two components of lambda, and capital A, which run over the four fermionic coordinates. These are the coordinates of on-shell N equals 4 superspace. So overall, this is an eight-component delta function. And if you factor that out of the whole thing, you just get a polynomial here in the Grassmann variables. First of all, you get 1. Then you get a term with 4 Grassmann variables. That's the NMHV amplitude. These things are sometimes called ratio functions because this thing P here is the ratio of the NMHV amplitude divided by the MHV amplitude. And this is the ratio function for N squared MHV, etc. Anyway, that's just by way of notation. BCFW, you see, one of the things about this talk is, you know, there are papers with hundreds and hundreds of citations which are going to get overlooked or going to get at most a single slide. So I just have to apologize for that. But you'll hear many more details in subsequent weeks. The Brito-Cochazzo-Fang-Witten recursion relation is a quadratic on-shell recursion relation, which schematically is of the following form. It says that you can compute at tree level, for the moment, any n particle scattering amplitude as a sum of products of lower point amplitudes. I'm suppressing a couple of the details, but the details are really, really very, very simple. They don't complicate the formula much at all. The important fact here is that these two amplitudes are evaluated at shifted momenta, but shifted in a way that they maintain both the on-shell condition individually and the overall momentum conservation individually. So you can calculate a physical gauge invariant on-shell tree amplitude by knowing products of lower point physical on-shell gauge invariant tree amplitudes. So every calculation you can do involves only physical data. This is something else that Svea Byrne emphasized in his colloquium on Tuesday. Now, the BCFW recursion has conceptual importance, but it also has practical importance because it lets you rapidly generate a lot of data. And data is good. What I mean by data is you can sit with this recursion and you can rapidly compute amplitudes that previously were impossible to compute. And then you can look at them and try to deduce if there's any other structure you might be missing or might have previously been hidden. And one thing I want to emphasize is that there's no single BCFW representation. Rather, at each stage in this recursion, there are certain choices you can make. Something special happened here. I singled out the legs 1 and n for preferential treatment, and I summed over where the split occurs from 2 to n minus 2. That was a choice I made. And so you can generate a lot of different representations by making different choices of how you glue the amplitudes together at each order in the recursion. For example, here's a famous example. The 6-particle NMHV tree-level amplitude has many different but equivalent BCFW representations. Here's one of them. It's a sum of these two terms. Here's another one in green that's the sum of those three terms. Now, in general, when you're faced with things like this, you can only check the equality of these two expressions by what we call numerical experimentation. So it's essentially impossible to sit down. I mean, with modern techniques, it's possible. It's trivial, but at the time when these kinds of formulas were first discovered, it was essentially impossible to sit down and analytically prove that this quantity is equal to that. And the reason is you're still using constrained variables, because you still have to impose the overall momentum conservation condition. So numerical experimentation means you choose random numerical values for all of your kinematic data. You check that this equals this numerically, and if you worry that maybe you accidentally got agreement, then you check again at a different kinematical point, or 10 to the 10 different kinematical points until you're completely satisfied. I'm throwing this up just for fun. There's something called Richardson's theorem. So mathematicians have been able to prove that there's no algorithm for determining if two mathematical expressions are equal. It's an undecidable problem. But we sidestep that in our field by using numerical experimentation. Andrew Hodges followed his nose. So the idea is, you know, if you've got two expressions that look completely different and yet they're equal, maybe there's a reason they're equal. And this is another thing that you've got to take seriously in the amplitudes business. You don't let any thread go unpulled. We're trying to unravel the whole structure of this theory. So Andrew wondered if there's a reason why, in this case, this two-term identity is equal to that three-term identity. And he found that, in fact, each of the two expressions computes the volume of a certain polytope in complex projective space, just triangulated in different ways. One way, you can triangulate it into two pieces, and then a different way, you slice it into three pieces. But the overall volume is the same, and that explains why the yellow formula is equal to the green formula. And now we know that all NMHV amplitudes can be understood as volumes. But anyway, I just mentioned this. I mean, I could give dozens and dozens of examples in our field of this is just one example, which shows you another important principle, which is that this really is an experimental science. And what I mean by that is you get the answer first by whatever means you can, however hard the calculation, and then you analyze it and try to understand what it's telling you. Okay, let me say a word about twister space. I realize I'm going extremely rapidly here, but I'm trying to get through all these buzzwords. At first I thought of putting the red curly quotes just around the mathematically ill-defined one-half Fourier transform. Then I decided to just be safe and put the curly quotes around this whole sentence. But very, very roughly speaking, you can think of going to twister space as carrying out a one-half Fourier transform. So what that means is you start with some amplitude as a function of the lambdas and the lambda bars, and you Fourier transform the lambda bars to new variables called mu. So now you've got an object that depends on four variables, two lambdas, two mu's, with the following property, that if you do an overall rescaling of all four of these variables, that scales lambda and lambda bar oppositely, because lambda bar is conjugate to mu, and hence it leaves the momentum unchanged. So these variables, these four variables, are projective coordinates. So they parametrize three-dimensional complex projective space, otherwise known as twister space. And the basic dictionary is that points in twister space are one-to-one correspondence with null rays in space-time, and lines in twister space, although here we mean complex lines, so things that are topologically a CP1 or a sphere, correspond to points in space-time. Okay, now, twister string theory. This is really where it all began for many of us in the early 2004. And really, looking back on it, it's just completely amazing. So Ed Witten noticed that if you put the MHV amplitude in the following form, now notice this is completely trivial. Okay, here's the familiar Park-Taylor form of the amplitude. And here I just found a clever way of writing the, well, not a dumb way of writing the overall momentum conserving delta function, right? I introduced a new integration d4x, some exponential, and what does that integral do? It enforces that this is equal to zero. So this is the momentum conserving delta function. Now, I don't know about you, but when I see D4X, I don't get too excited. But when Witten sees D4X, he says, oh, hey, that's the measure on the moduli space of lines in CP3. So from that observation, all else follows. And so Witten was motivated to invent a topological string theory on P3, which computes the tree level NK MHV amplitude as a certain integral over curves of degree k plus 1. And the topological string theory computes the correct measure factor for recovering amplitudes via this prescription. That's called the twister string. Moving on to loop level, a union of the work in the 90s due to Byrne and collaborators on the unitarity-based methods, together with some of these recent advances, particularly Brito, Cacciazzo, and Fang, allowed a lot more data to be computed, collected at loop level. So let me give you one example. The four-loop, four-particle amplitude in N equals 4 Yang-Mills theory was determined in late 2006 to be, I'm suppressing, of course, some details here, but was given to be the sum of these eight scalar integrals. So the idea here is, I emphasize, these are not to be interpreted as Feynman diagrams. Rather, the statement is that if you would take all of the Feynman diagrams which contribute to the four-loop, four-particle amplitude in N equals 4 Yang-Mills theory, add them up, and combine terms and do a whole lot of cancellation and algebraic manipulation, the result would be identical to the sum of these eight scalar Feynman integrals. So that's a rather non-trivial statement, but that's just the kind of magic that we're used to, with all due respect. Now, once you start looking at this data, it reveals a surprise. And the surprise is something called dual conformals. I'm also not being quite historically accurate, but the surprise is a mysterious new symmetry called dual conformal symmetry. Now, dual conformal symmetry, what is it? It's a non-local symmetry under which scattering amplitudes are covariant. So first of all, what scattering amplitudes have this symmetry? Well, in four dimensions, tree-level gluon amplitudes in QCD, and amplitudes to all orders in maximally supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory. This is a symmetry that has no understanding at the level of the Lagrangian, and you'll see why in a minute, because it only operates on shell quantities. A Lagrangian is inherently trying to provide you some off-shell information. So if you've got a symmetry which is only defined to act on shell quantities, you shouldn't be surprised that there's no Lagrangian understanding. And then I just wanted to mention the word covariant here means that this ratio function I talked about earlier is invariant. So the idea behind dual conformal symmetry is the following. I've mentioned this overall momentum conserving delta function several times. Let's try to trivialize it. What that means is you want to change variables from the k's to some new variables, x's, which are, in a sense, free. And you do that by the following transformation. You let k1 equals x1 minus x2, etc. This parametrization trades n variables k in exchange for n variables x, but in a way such that this constraint is automatically satisfied. Then the statement of dual conformal symmetry is that amplitudes in N equals 4 Yang-Mills theory to all orders in perturbation theory are invariant under conformal transformations on the x's. Let me show you an example. Now, you can realize this at tree level, but in order to see it at tree level, you have to introduce a little bit more complicated notation. So let me just show you a simple example at one loop. Let's look at the one-loop four-particle amplitude. So here's the ratio function I talked about earlier. You factor out this tree amplitude. And the result is given by the following expression due to Green, Schwartz, and Brink. So again, the idea is if you were strong enough to compute all the Feynman diagrams and add them up, they would miraculously collapse into this single expression. Of course, that's not how the calculation was done. You'd be foolish to try it, but that's what this formula means. So here I've just written out this single scalar Feynman integral in the normal parametrization. And now we're going to change to these dual variables, the x's. Okay, when you do that, you get an overall factor here. First of all, let me explain the notation. Xij squared is defined to be the difference between xi and xj. So these two factors out here come from the s and t that were sitting in front. And then I've introduced I've changed integration variables from p to a new variable I'm calling x5. And I associate x5 with the face of the diagram like so. So the basic idea is, I mean, you can already see where the word dual is coming from, because what I've drawn here is essentially the dual graph of what I had previously. So in momentum space, you label all your propagators, you label all the edges in a diagram. But in a dual diagram, you label all the faces. This face is x1, x2, x3, x4, and that face is x5. So the integral you have to do then transforms into this object, the integral over x5 of this simple ratio of squares of differences of distances. And now the observation is almost completely trivial. This has manifest conformal symmetry. Well, it obviously has scale invariance, rotation invariance, translation, all that. The only non-trivial thing you have to check is the inversion symmetry. And what happens if you invert these things is that they collect, if you invert an xij squared, it collects a factor of xi squared, xj squared downstairs. So the fact that that indices 1, 2, 3, and 4 appear upstairs the same number of times as they appear downstairs means that when you do an inversion, that factor cancels out. Now, x5 appears 4 times more, it appears 4 times downstairs and 0 times upstairs. But that the factor you get when you do the inversion on x5 is compensated by the factor you get from the Jacobian in the change of integration variable.
Marcus,
yes?
It's just simpler to say that this is the tree diagram for the full function, the x.
Of course. That's all it is, right. Absolutely. Yes, and so, yeah. Now, one important point is, of course, that specifying, if someone comes to you and specifies all of the x's, okay, if you specify all the x's, that determines all the k's. But the converse is not quite true. If someone comes to you and gives you a collection of k's, there's no unique choice of the x's because you have an ambiguity. You can do an overall translation in X space. So this slight mismatch in the amount of data that's presented in K space versus X space has very important consequences at loop level. And the reason is the following. Normally, the addition of distinct Feynman diagrams under the integral sign is somewhat ambiguous due to the lack of a natural origin. Let's say you were looking at this five particle amplitude, for example. Here's the idea. Let's say you were computing an amplitude which required you to add this Feynman diagram to this Feynman diagram. You see the external particles are a little bit differently labeled. And now let's say you compute this one and you write it as an integral. Let's say you're using dimensional regularization or whatever, DDP, of some rational function of your momenta and the loop integration variable. And this is some different rational function. And you might be tempted to try to combine these two under the integral sign, like so. Now, that's fine. You can certainly do that. But it's a little bit, well, it's non-canonical because here, you have a choice of which of these four legs. Well, I mean, you have even more choice than that. But, you know, I could have called this leg P and that leg P. But your neighbor sitting next to you doing the same calculation might have called this leg P here and that leg P there. So you would get completely different answers when you add the two things together at the level of the integrand. Now, of course, after doing the resulting integral, the two expressions would agree, but they would not agree at the level of the integrand. Now, the importance of the dual variables is that this ambiguity does not exist. So here's this Feynman diagram written in dual space, and there's that Feynman diagram written in dual space, and the sum of them is unambiguous. Now, why is this useful? The reason that this is useful is because often there can be enormous cancellations at the level of the integrand. So despite all the recent progress, it's still extremely complicated in general to carry out, to actually evaluate these integrals. I'll have more to say about that later. So as much as possible, we would like to try to see as much cancellation as we possibly can underneath the integral sign. And the fact that in a planar theory, you can assemble the integrand together in a canonical way is often helpful for making otherwise non-obvious cancellations manifest. Okay. Another terminology related to all of this is the concept of a leading singularity. As we've seen, the L-loop integrand is a rational function, which by definition has only simple poles in C4L, the loop momentum variables. And a leading singularity refers to a residue of this rational function at one of those poles. And the simplest type of leading singularities are relatively easy to compute because you just you draw a diagram like this and you say, well, if I want to know the residue of the pole where, let's say, these eight propagators all go simultaneously on shell, I can compute that just by taking the product of these seven tree amplitudes evaluated on the locus where these loop momentum evaluated at the points in loop momentum space where these propagators are on shell. And in general, there will be several different points. In this case, there will be several different points in C8 where all of these are on shell. So there will be potentially several different leading singularities. Jungian symmetry refers to the closure under commutation of the set of ordinary conformal transformations and dual conformal transformations. Together they form some big algebra called the Jungian. Another way to think about this is diffeomorphism invariance in twister space. R invariance, again, I'm just throwing out terminology. What?
The Jungian is diffeomorphism invariant?
Yes, yes, yes. You think that's not right?
Diffeomorphism invariant turns out.
Well, maybe we should discuss this further, but I'm...
I mean, it's just linear invariance in the two different twister spaces, really. So it's the SL4/4 in twister space and on momentum twister space joined is what they generate together.
Okay.
Sorry.
No.
I don't think it's different.
Okay. There's skepticism from that side, and I'm no longer sure of my claim. So let me get back to you on that. Another important set of objects which appear are some things called the R invariants. Again, this is just by way of introducing terminology that you'll see in future talks all over the place. This is a natural collection of Jungian invariant objects which constitute the basic building blocks for many things. For example, near the beginning of this talk when I showed you this identity where the sum of two terms was equal to the sum of three different looking terms, all those five objects were related to these things we call R invariants. They also appear as leading singularities of loop integrands. And a particularly beautiful way of thinking about them is that they're delta functions which constrain 5 points in CP3/4 to lie on a common CP3 subspace. The Grassmannian integral, again, one could give a whole talk just on this, but it only gets a single slide from me, unfortunately. This is a contour integral over the space of K by N matrices written down by Arkani Hamed et al, which takes the following form. Here you integrate over the space of K by N matrices. Downstairs, these are the minors, consecutive minors of the matrix C and some supersymmetric delta functions upstairs. This object is a generating function for all of the n particle nk MHV Yangian invariants. What that means basically is that all of the residues of this rational function, once you parameterize it in the right way, are these so-called R invariants. Okay, let me say a word about the strong coupling story, again, something that deserves many talks just in and of itself. Using ADS-CFT, Alde and Maldacena showed that amplitudes can be computed as certain Wilson loops, and hence as certain minimal area surfaces in ADS-5. I'll say much more about this very shortly. And one of the advantages of this is that it means that integrability methods can be brought to bear on the problem, specifically on the problem of finding the area of these minimal area surfaces. Now, one of the most remarkable developments, in addition to dual conformal invariants, which I've also mentioned, was the realization that this equality between amplitudes and Wilson loops, which was originally found by Alde and Maldacena at strong coupling, actually persists at weak coupling, and in fact is true order by order in perturbation theory. So the basic idea is the following. Here you have some scattering amplitude. It's a function of your external momenta, k1 through kn, all of which are null and which sum to zero by momentum conservation. The claim is that this scattering amplitude is identical to the expectation value of a Wilson loop on a polygon, an n-sided polygon composed of light-like edges, where each edge is literally a vector that points, you know, is literally the vector, let's say, k1, k2, k3, etc. You get a closed polygon because by momentum conservation, these all add up to zero. And the positions of the vertices here at the cusps, at the corners of this polygon, are these dual variables x, which I used previously. So again, this was originally realized by Alde and Maldacena at strong coupling, and then heroic calculations in perturbation theory established it started establishing it order by order in perturbation theory. Oh, and I should be generous and cite myself there, but well, it's okay that I don't cite myself, but I feel bad for my collaborators, so I'm sorry to my collaborators. And this has now been proven in general at the level of the integrand. So this is another in a long line of examples of things where heroic and very difficult calculations had to be done, because people might have thought you're crazy if you say, oh, the scattering amplitude is equal to some Wilson loop. So you do some really, really hard calculations. People start to believe you. And once you believe something strong enough, then you can contemplate the idea of formulating a general proof. But see, you need that data, you need the hard calculation before you can provide the motivation for going after a proof. There's another way in which you can compute the integrand. This is kind of cute too. It involves correlation functions. So you take some half, again I'm skipping many details, you take some half BPS operators, you insert them at light-like separated points. So you insert them, I'm not calculating a Wilson loop now, but I'm going to use the same picture. You insert a bunch of operators at some points in space-time. And if you want the L-loop integrand, you can compute, it's a rational function of the external data and the loop momentum variables. You can compute it by computing this correlation function, where these are some Lagrangian insertions at the loop integration, at the points where you want the loop integration variable to sit. And again, this has now been proven at the level of the integrand. Now, importantly, all of these things about proofs at the level of the integrand are made possible by really remarkable choice of variables for n-particle kinematics. So it really is impossible to overstate the importance of having good variables. And in particular, you want free variables, because if you have two expressions and you're trying to determine if they're equal or not, if you're using variables that satisfy some complicated or especially some polynomial constraints, it may be incredibly difficult or impossible to determine if the two things you're staring at are actually equal to each other. But if you manage to find a choice of variables that trivializes all of the constraints you have, then you're good to go. Okay, so we've seen earlier in my talk that spinner helicity variables trivialize the on-shell condition, k squared equals zero for each massless particle. On the other hand, the dual variables, xi, they trivialize the overall momentum conservation. So you can imagine it's a match made in heaven to try to merge these two things. And this was accomplished by Andrew Hodges with variables that are now known as momentum twister variables. So these things are completely free variables that simultaneously satisfy the on-shell condition and the momentum conservation constraint. Okay, so I think, except for one more thing, that ends my laundry list of terminology. So I apologize if it's been somewhat dry and thrown at you in a very hasty way, but you're going to see these terms all the time in the next few weeks. So I thought, why not just get them all out there in the beginning? Let me take a step back now and say a few general words about the state of the field as far as N equals Fourier-Mills theory is concerned. And I think it's fair to say that one revolution has essentially, there's probably more to learn, but has essentially come to fruition. And that revolution has to do with processing the integrand using all of the sexy new technology that we've developed, starting from generalized unitarity in the 90s, through BCFW, through the realization of the importance of dual conformal symmetry, and all of these things. So we really have extremely good control now. In fact, I forgot to mention this, but due to the work of Arkani Hamed and collaborators, the BCFW recursion relation itself now has been extended to compute this integrand. So if you want to know the integrand for the n-particle L-loop amplitude, in principle, there's a recursion relation that will give it to you, although not necessarily in a very pleasant form. But anyway, my point is that all of the exciting new technology has been almost exclusively aimed at the processing of this object, the sum of the Feynman diagrams, under the integral sign. Now, of course, another revolution is desperately needed, because it remains the case that actually evaluating these loop integrals is still generally very, very nasty. And there has certainly been progress, but it's been incremental compared to the lightning speed of this kind of progress. So the last thing on my list of terminology is something called the BDS remainder function. So for MHV amplitudes, the natural observable that we talk about at loop level is the so-called BDS remainder function. And what that is that's what's left after you do an appropriate subtraction of the infrared divergences from your L loop amplitude, leaving behind something which is both finite and dual conformally invariant. Now, it turns out that the first, so using this sense of BDS subtraction, which again I haven't written any formulas for, but the first non-trivial loop amplitude, in a sense, is then the two-loop, six-particle MHV amplitude. And the reason is that The definition of the BDS subtraction, well, it has some very nice natural properties, but one of the things it does is it totally subtracts the one loop piece for any number of particles, so that's gone. So you have to start at two loops to get anything non-trivial. And then you have to start with six particles, because if you have fewer than six particles, there's no way to write down a dual conformally invariant cross ratio. Normally, you're used to a cross ratio of 4 points, something like Z12, Z34 over Z13, Z24. Here, however, because our points are light-like separated, the analogous cross ratio x12 squared x34 squared in the numerator would be 0. So the first time you can get a non-trivial cross ratio when your points are light-like separated is with six particles. And because this BDS remainder function, as I said, has to be a dual conformally invariant quantity, that means it has to be a function of cross ratios only. So the first time you can get a non-trivial answer is starting at six particles. Okay, so according to my definition then of non-trivial loop amplitude, and again, I should say, you know, it's very important to maintain camaraderie in this field. Many people, myself included, have invested huge amount of sweat and tears into laborious calculations of things that are now understood by this, you know, mean criterion to be trivial. So in retrospect, we understand all that hard work as providing evidence for dual conformal symmetry. So, you know, it all fits together. We're all friends. It's hard work. And and sometimes you got to do hard work to get an answer and for the benefit of the team, right? So this non-trivial loop amplitude, the first non-trivial loop amplitude, was first computed analytically in late 2009. Actually, the way they did it was by using the fact that it's equal to the corresponding Wilson loop, something that a collaboration of Byrne, Dixon, Kalsauer, myself, Radu, Volovich, and Vergu established numerically a few years ago. It was first computed analytically by Del Duca, Durr, and Smirnov. And so let me show you their analytic result for what I remind you is the first non-trivial loop amplitude. So there are some special functions here. I was once accused of hitting the backwards and forwards button on my computer. But I assure you, I'm only hitting the forwards button. And I think I even left off the last line. There was an additional line. So the idea is, if that were really the best we could do, we should all just quit now, because there's no hope. Motivated by that sentiment, Goncharov, Vergu, Volovich, and I used some mathematic magic, which I wish I had more time to talk about, called the symbol of a transcendental function. I'm sure it's something we'll hear much more about. We were able to simplify this expression down to a single line involving nothing more complicated than the standard Pauli logarithm functions, LIN. Now, it's important to emphasize, you know, this is kind of embarrassing, because, you know, one of the things about this field is if you don't understand the cult, you just don't get it. So for 6 months last year, I had to go around and people were asking me what I was working on, and I'd be like, oh yeah, I'm, you know, some guys wrote a formula, I'm trying to simplify it. And you just don't get it, right? It sounds absurd. But the point is that the worth of our formula is not that it computes the value of the two-loop six-point MHV amplitude. So this is where the N equals 4 community, I think, completely differs from the QCD community. You know, the QCD community, they need to know the value of the, you know, NNLO, Higgs production, et cetera, et cetera. Nobody cares about the value of the two-loop six-point amplitude in N equals 4 Yang-Mills theory, especially not me. I mean, I couldn't care less about the value of this amplitude. Rather, the importance of these kinds of calculations are because they provide hope where previously there was none, that we might really begin to unlock all of the secrets of n equals Fourier-Ingalls theory to all orders. Looking forward, we do not yet know the full symbol of more general amplitudes, though this is under active investigation, and data is accumulating both from the Wilson loop side. There was a recent paper by Gaiato, Malvicena, Sever, and Vieira, and also on the amplitude side with intensive investigation by Akani Hamed, Karan Huot, myself, Volovich, Vergu, others very likely looking at aspects of this problem. But this leads to my third point about the philosophy of amplitudeology, which is the simplicity really has to be believed before you can see it. So if you really didn't feel in your heart and soul that you know n equals Fourier-Ingalls theory has to be kinder to you than the 17-page DDS formula, then there's no motivation for you to get out of bed every morning and do these hard calculations. But our community shares a belief that not only is n equals 4 Fourier-Ingalls theory remarkably beautiful, but it's beautiful beyond our possible imaginations. And every nook and cranny we look into contains a new surprise and a new structure that previously had been unimaginable. So in conclusion, if you find these three principles compelling, please join us for a fun ride over the next 3 months here at the KITP. Thanks.
So I'd like to understand this amazing sort of simplification.
Well, if the organizers invite me or my collaborators to give another talk.
Let me just ask my question. So this amplitude depends on six momenta.
Yes, but really it depends only on three. You can
three cross ratios.
From that data, you can construct three cross ratios. So it's a function of three real variables.
Okay, and you're saying that long 17-page formula, it has numerically the same values as your one-line formula for all values
of
those three things.
For all values of those three, yes.
Can we see that one-line formula?
Yeah, unfortunately, it depends on your definition of line. I'll get it ready for you, but maybe there's another question.
So the dialogue rhythm has a natural interpretation as sort of the volume of a polytope sitting on hyperbolic space, which you might think of in terms. So I know you showed this other formula where you rewrote the loop amplitude as an insertion of operators at points and then plus some extra Lagrangian. So obviously there's ABS-CFT provide the duality between just insertions of these operators and some sort of volume of a polytope. Do these higher poly logarithms have the same interpretation?
I don't know. It's fascinating to speculate. Again, because of my religious faith in n equals Fourier-Ingalls theory, I'm sure the answer is yes, but I can't give a detailed answer. It's not understood.
I mean, it's true at one loop.
Yeah, right. here's the idea. Okay, so the final result, there are three variables, U1, U2, U3. There's a function called L4. L4 is let me start from the beginning. No, it's not so bad. If I can find something. Okay. Yeah. Little L4 means Li4 of that argument plus Li4 of 1 over that argument. It turns out you have to jump through a lot of hoops to get the branch structure of this thing right. There's an identity that relates Li4 of x to Li4 of 1 over x modulo plus lower order terms modulo branch cuts. If you don't care about branch cuts, you can write a much simpler formula. But script L4 means leaf 4 of this plus leaf 4 of 1 over that. Similarly, L3 means leaf 3 of that plus leaf 3 of 1 over that. So then you create this nice linear combination that's basically leaf 4 minus a half log times leaf 3 plus 1/8 log squared leaf 2, etc. And then you sum that over three different variables, and the xi and xi plus and xi minus are just some simple rational functions of the UIs. They're basically the solutions to some simple quadratic. X plus and x minus are the two roots of a pretty simple quadratic equation whose coefficients are rational functions in the U's. And then the last thing here is some little L1s. We call that J because it looked like junk. Actually, we understand much better now. We understand much better now exactly what that term is doing there and why it's there. And were we to write the paper again today, we would give it a much more polite name than J. But there's some problem there. And then there's, of course, the important plus pi to the fourth over 72, because one of the most demanding constraints on this function is that it has to vanish in any collinear limit. So this thing computes the expectation value of a hexagonal Wilson loop. And if you take a limit where any two adjacent legs of the hexagon become parallel, so you get a pentagon, the nature of the BDS subtraction, one of its virtues, is that it's supposed to have smooth collinear limits. So this thing, in the limit when the hexagon becomes a pentagon, has to go over smoothly to the pentagon remainder function. But the pentagon remainder function is zero, because there are no dual conformal invariant cross ratios. You could have allowed for a constant, maybe, but the BDS subtraction kills the constant, too. So that plus pi to the fourth over 72 is crucial to ensure that this thing vanishes at all collinear limits. But OK, that's probably the longest answer to a question I've given. But I hope you enjoy seeing the formula. Yeah?
To what extent does the dual superconformal story extend to gravity?
Oh, well, probably none at all. It's crucial that you have planarity. The whole construction relies on planarity. What?
Exactly.
Well, you're so perhaps in a better case. Naive.
I'll answer that question
next week.
He's basically right.
No, the naive answer is not at all. But we all know that there's something important which replaces it or is even better than it, and we look forward to hearing about that from Tsvi next week. Right?
That's enough focus selling.
Well, you set yourself up for it, so. Yes?
Probably an old-fashioned question, but is dual superconformal symmetry visible in the Lagrangian QCD?
No, not at all, because again, it only only is a symmetry of on-shell quantities.
But that's still a symmetry.
No.
It's a symmetry of
the symmetry of the large n limit.
Of course.
You're having something which is first of all visible in the planar limit, but you're saying also on-shell. But so you think it's just something which I cannot? It's not a symmetry of the Lagrangian in any
large n limit.
Yeah.
I mean, you said it's the level one master generators of the Yangian. So the Yangian's not visible at the level of the Lagrangian either.
I guess that was an answer to our question, yeah.
Derivative expansions are generally not, in quantum physics, are generally not expected to converge.
Right.
So do you see that this method might be absolutely some Borel summation?
Well, n equals Fourier Engel theory is very special. And one of the things about it is that there are quantities which have finite radii of convergence. I don't know if any of this. We're in a lucky situation here.
Here says that the planar limits is convergence, isn't it?
I believe, yeah.
I don't know the proof, but I mean, that's sort of solving that.
Yeah. Yeah.
What are the extra buzzwords that are going to come in the next year?
Oh, in the next year, the new buzzwords. Well, those are top secret. Each one of us has their own top secret buzzwords that they're waiting to introduce, right? I'm not sure.
Well, motive appeared on your first slide.
Motive, yes. So, the very good. So the mathematics that underlies the technology we use to simplify these polylogarithm functions has to do with something called mixed motives. And it's some kind of generalization it's supposed to be sort of the general, most general possible in the whole universe kind of cohomology theory. And I don't really know much about it. I think most people don't know much about it because their community is also very cult-like. It's hard to get anything out of them. The Wikipedia page says that mixed motives aren't even in general defined. They're kind of something that mathematicians they're looking for a way to define them so that they have some nice properties. The general sentiment is that the class of amplitudes that we encounter in N=4 Yang-Mills theory somehow constitute a Hopf algebra and are all related to each other in some beautiful and mysterious way, and we're just beginning to see the tip of the iceberg. And I've said 10 times more than I have any right to say, given my limited knowledge on that, but we're just at the beginning.
Well, let's thank Marcus again.